Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this episode of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Lots to talk about on this episode. As per usual, we've got Walmart's annual Shareholders Day, an interesting lawsuit coming out of North Carolina affecting the dollar store industry, and Restoration Hardware as their shares took a beating on Wall Street this last week. But we begin with Ollie's Bargain Outlet as they reported earnings for their fiscal first quarter and saw healthy growth. This episode of the Retail Focus Podcast is brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. With Third Wave Water, you can make coffee as good, if not better, than your local coffee shop. With their proprietary water treatment formula, it costs less than 10 cents per cup, and it'll cost even less if you go to their website and use the promo code FOCUS. That's Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. Now, with Ollie's Bargain Outlet, shares popped over 3.5% on Wednesday after their fiscal first quarter release of finances, and then over 5% on Thursday with continued positive momentum into the second day as shares briefly touched an all-time high of $44 per share. We should preface that 5% on Thursday with noting that the market was up very healthily in retail specifically on Thursday, so there was some, no doubt, crossover boost from that. When you look at Ollie's and the beat here, this was all due to revenue and profit versus the consensus expectations of analysts. As revenue and profit both beat those expectations, shares did end up reaching an all-time high, topping $227 million from $193.7 million in 2016. This beat analysts' average estimates by $7.6 million or by about 3%. So it's a really solid beat on top-line revenue or on their sales. Same-store sales, meanwhile, came in around 1.7%. This is a little bit softer than what it was in the first quarter last year, where it came in at 6%. This was due to a slight reduction in traffic, but a positive sign for the company is that they saw an increase in average basket size, so that was able to more than offset the slight reduction in traffic. Manolis said during the analyst Q&A during this earnings call that they weren't so worried about the falling traffic because last year's traffic comps were so strong. They were 5% up, where basket was only up 1% last year. I think the fact that you see basket size up so strong this year is a positive sign heading forward for Ollie's, and it confirms what the company already knew, which is that some of their regular customers and some of their loyalty program members are beginning to spend more at the individual stores. We were expecting to see same-store sales around 2 to 3%, so Leighton and I were a little bit higher than most analyst estimates because we acknowledged the maturation of some of the older locations, but we also took into consideration a more robust membership program. They didn't quite reach that 2 to 3% because they saw that slight decrease in traffic, which was a slight surprise to both Leighton and I. Net income grew 62% year over year to $19 million or 29 cents per share. Including one-time expenses, the company recorded 25 cents per share earning. This gap measure was expected to be 23 cents per share by experts, so again, beating by a healthy percentage in terms of net income. And I think, Leighton, when you look at the year-over-year growth by Ollie's, they're able to go not only through expansion, but also through same-store sales growth as a function of increased basket size. All of this very positive going forward for Ollie's. This is a company we're already pretty bullish on.
Absolutely, we are. And it just as a full disclaimer, I am long in Ollie's Bargain Outlet. And you see the company really firing on all cylinders throughout this past earnings call. You see gross margin increased as well, 17.6%, but this is in terms of the net contribution. Cost of goods was actually flat at 40.8%. Still a very respectable figure. Anything over 35% we consider is fairly solid. Cost of goods was a function of lower logistics costs, but slightly more expensive products. The good news is that they seem to be effectively adjusting their increased size with their distribution center. During the Q&A, their CEO had mentioned that really they're able to leverage their distribution center into distributing out to all of the more locations they have, and we'll get into those figures in a bit. But you see them growing out, but they're growing out in a very responsible fashion. They are, however, guiding for about 40.3% gross margin for the full year. So you see about 50 basis points less than what they ticked in this quarter. The company did give a healthy outlook, and we'll get into that as well. But you're seeing that the financial media really only had one negative thing to say, and that is the timid same-store sales outlook for the company. The company thinks they should be coming in around 1% for the rest of the full year, 1% to 2% to be exact. Overall, you see our expectations, as you had noted, Trent, between 2% and 3% for the full year and this previous quarter. So you really have to wonder, can they perform a little bit better, or are they perhaps just sandbagging? You look inside the details of this earnings call and you see that the positivity surrounding CEO Mark Butler's statements are prevalent here. There were three executives on the call: the Senior Vice President of Finance, Jay Statz, and then CFO John Seiwert. And you see that the team very happy with the results over the past 3 months. But not only that, they're happy about the future of their business. As they said, they're performing financially as strong as ever. And they did point out over the past quarter, they could have performed even better, Trent, with the tax return volatility and the Easter shift, which we've been talking about over the past 2 weeks as these earnings reports are coming in for both restaurants and the retail sector. Tax returns probably did affect the business a little more than usual, as you and I were talking before airing this, that really this is a type of business that you would see those types of customers with that extra discretionary income. This is where it may be spent, other than maybe new car sales and things of that nature that others have been talking about. Those big ticket items may not be as affected in all, because a lot of those items are financed. With all these bargain outlet, obviously these are cheaper goods, more reactionary type items. People come in, people buy it because they have the extra little money. Management was quick to mention their expense control, which is a fairly new aspect of the company because they are growing. So I think last quarter was the first quarter they really mentioned having a tighter budget overall to try to increase that bottom line. And this is something that is a relatively new concept when you look at a company that is expanding so much. You're seeing near 20% gross margin increasing, the bottom line increasing by about the same proportion, as well as revenue. So this is an interesting take. As they are getting more mature, they probably do see some benefit into looking at the individual stores, trying to get them to run a little bit more efficiently. The company kept expenses tight despite opening 5 new stores. They announced their first location in Rhode Island, in fact, and they have already opened 7 new stores since the end of the first reporting period. So that's extremely good. They listed an ending store count for the first quarter. However, that's going to be boosted by 7 because of those openings. Jay Statz, their chief accounting officer that we mentioned that was on the call. Interesting enough, Trent, I did a little bit of background research. He had 17 years in at Sports Authority in the financial side of the business. Sporting goods, however, was not expressly mentioned in their stronger functional areas throughout the store. Electronics, health and beauty, clothing, floor coverings, and pets were the strongest areas mentioned during the earnings call. And you see that overall, most of these areas of strength were seen in the last quarter. So they keep on pushing what has been successful for them in the past. The only exception to this, I believe, is clothing, where you do see some better margins. And you do see a lot more businesses shutting their doors that had clothing in the past, a lot more insurance claims regarding businesses that had offered clothing. So I'm sure their supplier management is all over these types of deals. Pets is always going to be a high margin business for them. It's also a high demand business. And if you look and dig a little bit deeper into that category specifically, you see that the U.S. pet industry consumer expenditure is expected to rise nearly 4% in 2017 versus 2016, bringing in a whopping nearly $70 billion. This is a 10% increase in pet sales seen year over year if you go back to 2016. And this is all according to the American Pet Products Association. They really keep close tabs on the market and how it's expanding. The market's expanding almost double what GDP is. So a lot more people with pets, a lot more people wanting pet supplies. They want to entertain their pets at home. And Ollie's is certainly trying to take advantage of that. I spoke briefly about the deal flow through supplier management. Deal flow is the term the company uses for product procurement, and this was said to be strong. They said they see a lot more deals coming in as they grow out, and this was something that we questioned, Trent, because as they grow their store base, they have to have a certain amount more products coming in to fill their store. So one would say there may just be a finite number of insurance claims and closeout deals that they can take advantage of, but it actually seems to be increasing in proportion to their store count. So better access to deals and executing on acquiring a larger network of vendors continues to be the main mission for management here. And we spoke last quarter about management saying that they actually need to be potentially more selective again, which we had questioned because this is a company that needs as much product as they can get to get on their store floors. And they see an increasing level of inventory even because of these deal flows increasing. And you see, to house the merchandise, they saw inventory come up 19.5%, but they kind of reassured analysts that this inventory in the stores or coming into the stores to be warehoused, so to speak, was important in that they had procured some really excellent deals. And the call they did address, their dynamic is a little bit different than your conventional retailer in that once they get a shipment, it often happens so fast that they have to adjust the in-store planning. So if you get a deal that you didn't foresee coming, let's say it comes within 2 days, you have to really act on the floor to make not only room for that product, but then advertise that product. Those people that are within that Ollie's membership program and the people that are within that local community have to somehow be aware that you have something new and unique that they can really go to the store and try to get. But overall, Mark Butler expressed confidence in that what they're doing with their team and how they've been managing their deals is on the up and up, and they have all the adaptive traits needed to be sustainable for the future.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Ollie's certainly has is room to store that inventory. If you've ever been to an Ollie's Bargain Outlet, you know that they use a lot of reused real estate, a lot of old Kmarts, a lot of older big box stores. They'll go ahead and put stores in there. And what often happens if their inventory rates aren't high enough, you end up with a lot of empty shelf space. But again, they can build up in terms of shelf space vertically. They have a lot of room, as most of these buildings have higher ceilings. It's not closed in like a TJ Maxx or a Ross or a Tuesday Morning or another player in this off-price sector. So they do have room for that increase in inventory. And I think we both regard it as a good thing that they were able to build on their inventory and garner more deals. If you're not a regular listener to the podcast, Ollie's has mentioned the fact that they are having more suppliers come to them with these deals on merchandise, whether they be insurance settlements or otherwise, because of the fact that they're publicly traded, and now because of the fact that they're more apparent in the public eye than they were before the point where they were publicly traded. And so that certainly helps in terms of that expense control that Leighton was talking about, as does the whole economies of scale concept, because they are building out their chain, they're making it larger, so they have extra outlets for any excess inventory if need be. But one of the other aspects is they are a relatively newly publicly traded company. And so the idea of expense control is always going to be there as a private company. But again, you're keeping an extra close eye on it for shareholder purposes when you are a publicly traded company. And I think that's also helped them out in terms of operations as they're going forward and as they have to kind of keep an eye on it. One more add-on to something that Leighton said. He talked about the Easter shift and the idea that the fact that Easter shifted into this quarter for Ollie's kind of hurt them a little bit. But I think overall it is kind of a wash, because they have talked about the seasonality of their merchandise, trying to sell more seasonal options. And if they were able to execute on that front, they likely saw enough merchandise sales to offset the fact that they were closed on Easter Sunday versus not being closed on Easter Sunday. Let's talk briefly about their Ollie's Army membership program, which is one of the reasons why we said basket size has increased at Ollie's, despite the fact that traffic is down by about 8%. The membership program is growing at a faster rate than sales, which is a very good thing for them. They grew at a 29% pace, which they cited as normal. Now, obviously, there's going to be some sort of cap on percentage growth, but that's an excellent year-over-year, quarter-over-quarter growth pattern for their Ollie's Army membership program. They believe they have 7.9 million members, but I'm a little bit worried about the fact that they use the term believe instead of they have 7.9 million members. I think there's certainly some white space there in terms of data management for Ollie's to be a little bit stronger about what their customers want and what their customers desire, so they can procure deals that are more tailored to the members of their membership program. The program is free, by the way, and they've still found that members do purchase more than non-members, hence basket size going up during this last quarter when membership grew at a 29% pace. Looking at the balance sheet overall, seems pretty healthy. They have no current borrowings from a $100 million revolving credit line, so very healthy despite the fact, as Leighton mentioned, that they are growing in terms of store count, and they continue to plan on growth in terms of store count. They paid down $66.3 million in debt, and they now have less than two-thirds the term loan debt they had at this time last year, so the company is focusing on putting themselves in a positive position should something unseen happen in the future. They've got a lot of debt, a lot of revolving credit to work with. And yet, they still ended the quarter with $33.7 million in cash. So everything on the balance sheet in terms of interest coming from these loans, in terms of paying off these long-term loans, this is all a very positive sign. And I should also note to listeners that unlike Leighton, I don't have a position in Ollie's. So I might be looking at it from a little bit more of an objective lens, but still their balance sheet looks incredibly healthy, and they're looking forward now because they paid down so many of these loans to lowered interest expense for the next several quarters. Now, in terms of financial guidance and their operational goals, Leighton had already mentioned looking at 1 to 2% positive comps for the rest of fiscal 2017. This is where certain analysts were pegging some potential sandbagging, and we do note that Ollie's has a trend of beating their same store sales metrics, and I think Leighton and I are probably keeping our expectations right around 2 to 3% growth in same store sales for the rest of 2017, so a full percentage point higher than where Ollie's has it internally. Full year earnings per share, Ollie's is looking between $1.18 and $1.21 per share, so about $123 to $125 million in net income. Thomson Reuters up until now had estimated $1.14 per share, so Ollie's does bump it up a little bit from the consensus estimates after such a solid first quarter. However, the revenue guidance range by the company did barely meet analyst expectations, hitting on the $1.04 billion mark. Almost exactly, Ollie's did raise this figure from previous guidance. The company is planning to help revenue increases out by opening a total of 33 to 35 new stores with no closures or relocations expected. So they're not going to be spending a whole lot of money closing stores or relocating stores or remodeling stores. None of that was mentioned, but they plan to open, again, 33 to 35 new stores to help bump up that top line revenue. Their total capital expenditures look to be about $18 to $20 million for the year, and it doesn't cost them as much to open up a new store because they are oftentimes using secondhand real estate or real estate that may not be in a popular retail district. We mentioned how the vacated Kmarts make a great space for Ollie's, especially with a larger square foot model. But Ollie's said going forward, they're looking to stay with a basic 30 to 33 square foot store model. Some of their stores are much larger than this, anywhere between 90 to 120,000 square feet. Some bigger markets will see high 30s, low 40s going forward, but they don't want to deviate much from this particular model. But again, if you're looking at some of that real estate that's left over, having a flexible model is important for Ollie's, even if you're segmenting off a good amount of that store for warehouse space to fit some of this excess inventory in. I think it's a good idea for Ollie's to be jumping on the real estate market now. And honestly, they stand to benefit long term for the next 10 to 20 years from all of these retail closures that we're seeing from some of these legacy operators.
Yeah, and you see a Kmart that is actually in a market near where I live. It's 105,000 square feet, but they say they will divide it. And I think this is an opportunity for them to get in and be able to get a good deal on these types of things, these vacant lots where the commercial real estate people that are involved with these transactions are able to redevelop the property and maybe make a space that is around 30 to 40,000 square feet for a type of store like Ollie's. Shares, as noted, struck an all-time high on Thursday of this week. Currently trading, however, down a little bit from that all-time high of $44 a share, between $42 and $43 a share currently. The price-to-earnings ratio is about 41 times earnings. The $2.67 billion market cap is a healthy one for the company. A lot of expectations surrounding this company are positive, but you see them growing at their store count, as you noted, Trent, about 33 to 35 new stores for the full fiscal year. That's a lot, and if they can keep up that momentum, they certainly are worth every penny in terms of market cap down the line. We move on to our second story in Dollar Express, which has officially filed suit against Dollar Tree, which is the parent company of course, Dollar Tree, but also Family Dollar, as they acquired Family Dollar back at the end of 2015. The filing was on Thursday of this week. The 2015 acquisition of Family Dollar by Dollar Tree came with a lot of criticism in that the company would have maybe too much of a footprint inside the United States in terms of their dollar store design. Dollar Tree openly argued that the company needed to be able to compete more aggressively with Walmart. And this is something we've heard a lot of through the workings of Dollar General and things like that, where you're seeing that as far as the price stance with Walmart right now, they are competing aggressively in categories such as groceries and housewares. And you see, this is very tough for places like Dollar Tree and Dollar General to compete because they're seeing inflation start to budge a little bit here in 2017. And so in order to keep along with Walmart's pricing strategy, they're really going to be having to take advantage of economies of scale. And this is something that Dollar Tree tried to do by acquiring hundreds of Family Dollar locations throughout the United States. Executives with Dollar Tree at the time also said they'd be coming together, which would lead to around $300 million in synergies, or in other words, cost savings for the company. Potential antitrust concerns from the FTC had caused the company to end up divesting around 330 stores in around 35 total states. The stores were all Family Dollar stores, and they were sold to a private equity firm, and this is a private equity firm that is no stranger to the Retail Focus podcast, Sycamore Partners, which, as most of our listeners know by now, have a deep retail presence with ownership stake in Hot Topic, Casper, Jones New York, The Limited, among about a dozen other retail banners. And now I actually visited their website, and the private equity firm is actually now saying that, according to their front page, this is mostly what they're going to be into for the long term. Retail is what they do now. So this is an interesting take because it looks as though they are going to be divesting the Family Dollar banner now. The legal claims are a fairly interesting and unique, Trent, because these aren't really what we were expecting. Sycamore is stating that Dollar Tree intentionally opened new locations near the divested store. So Dollar Tree is trying to cannibalize the old Family Dollar locations by opening nearby stores, or that is what is alleged here in this lawsuit. Originally, we were thinking that the case would be here where they're selling off these Family Dollar stores that were perhaps financially underperforming or stores that had manipulated sales figures. You see a lot of franchisees selling off locations where potentially in the past with other retailers and even other restaurants where franchisees can manipulate sales figures, and then you see lawsuits down the line when sales that were expected don't come to fruition for the future buyer of the branches or the locations. But another claim that is being levied against Dollar Tree is that they were assigning ineffective and inexperienced store managers to the divested locations. So the argument here is that they were restructuring the localized management before they were handed over to the Sycamore Group. And I think this is an interesting claim because, again, this is something that we haven't heard a lot of. And this is going to be something that is going to be hard to prove in court. You're trying to say that the managers were ineffective. That's one thing. But to say that they were inexperienced and that they were purposely put in place to not see a successful future is another. Damages are said to exceed nearly $500 million. However, with the caveat being the final amount will, of course, be issued in court after both sides do their due diligence. Adding to the complexity is the sale of the newly formed Dollar Express stores to Dollar General.
That's right, because at the end of April, the Federal Trade Commission approved a buyout offer from Dollar General for these Dollar Express stores. And the sale was said to be for 323 stores, again, seven fewer than the 330 that Sycamore Partners originally took from Family Dollar in order to make the Dollar Tree Family Dollar acquisition work. The amount used for the purchase of these stores was not given, but we'll likely know within two quarters as a result of Dollar General's financials. I doubt they're going to make this particular amount public. At least Sycamore Partners probably won't with this ongoing legal action that's taking place. But Dollar General, because they are a publicly traded company, they will eventually have to make the amount known in a financial release. We'll be waiting for that with bated breath. There are three things to note regarding the transaction between Dollar General and Dollar Express here. One is that the transaction is yet to close. The proposed date for the transaction is sometime in June. So questions may arise as to whether Dollar General, in purchasing these stores, will be hampered by an ongoing lawsuit between the former owner of these Dollar Express stores and Dollar Tree. An additional thing to note is that there may be less credibility in this lawsuit about the value of the stores if it comes out that Dollar General sees value in them, and not only sees value in them, but has potentially purchased them for more than what Sycamore Partners purchased these stores from Family Dollar for in 2015. If that number is higher, then in that circumstance, I cannot imagine a judge actually siding with Dollar Express were this legal action to go all the way through its course and not be settled ahead of time. Again, the sale is for 323 stores. So Sycamore had to close 7 locations since taking ownership in 2015. And I want to note to our listeners that we've had a close eye on this situation for a long time. At some point last year, it was said that Dollar Express stores would begin a rebranding process. However, a visit to the Dollar Express website revealed the same 4 pages, all the way, in fact, until March of 2017, and they were basically generic landing pages. You had nothing but a logo, the Photoshopped logo, onto a brick-and-mortar retail store, and maybe 3 pieces of clip art of a retail store, and that was it. There was very little information on the website other than the locations and a map to find the locations. There was not any information as far as circulars, any in-store sales. And what this leads me to believe is that the rebrand of these Dollar Express stores never really got started in earnest. Because again, if you're trying to rebrand Dollar Express as a standalone outfit, you would begin to put out some of those weekly circulars or some of those monthly deals. You would at least advertise what you sold on your website. The website had at most 3 to 4 paragraphs total of text for potential customers. So it was very difficult to see how they were going to make themselves work as a standalone entity when they didn't even have a website developed. And you're talking about a cost that's very insubstantial for a chain of over 300 stores. How difficult is it to really put together a functional website that's more than just a landing page, which is what their website had been? The second aspect I want to try and convey to our listeners is, again, these stores were operating as Family Dollar as per the agreement until the rebrand took place. But again, as recently as November 2016, because I was interested about the process of the rebrand, difficult to tell from the web whether anything had been rebranded, I began to call some of these acquired stores, and each one answered the phone as a Family Dollar. So their identity was still there as a Family Dollar. And again, if you're going to make something work as a freestanding enterprise, you have to engage in a rebrand. Otherwise, it just looks like another Family Dollar. And this is where the problem might come in. If you had rebranded the stores to Dollar Express and then a Family Dollar moves in, maybe you don't lose as many customers to that new nearby Family Dollar store as you do if you just keep your store a Family Dollar and then another Family Dollar moves in a block away. So I think at some point here, you have to kind of put the blame on Sycamore Partners. But what Layton and I had talked about off the record is we were a little bit suspicious of this deal to begin with because of the lack of a media presence for Dollar Express, because of a lack of information on the Dollar Express website, and because of the lack of the rebrand. What we had actually kind of half expected to happen, and again, this isn't necessarily through analysis, but this was more of a gut feel, is potentially that these 300-some stores would maybe declare bankruptcy and then be bought out by another buyer. And in this case, you have Dollar General swooping in to buy these stores after the employees were laid off in March. Dollar General would not have likely been included in a buyout of stores from Family Dollar when that Dollar Tree and Family Dollar deal was going down because they are a main competitor. So Sycamore came in, and again, we'll find out here in a couple of quarters what they sell it to for Dollar General. But I think both of our initial expectations was that this was kind of a quick flip for Sycamore Partners. This wasn't a long-term position for them as far as an investment in a new dollar store chain and what would have been Dollar Express. It looked like a short-term enterprise. The fact that they didn't engage in any rebrands and the fact that they didn't invest in a website or any type of online circulars kind of confirms as such, and this all just has kind of an interesting stench to it here overall as we await kind of the outcome of A, the lawsuit, but B, the sale that's going on.
And there may be some other ramifications we have yet to touch on. One being with Dollar General, is earlier this year, they laid about plans to have 1,000 new stores inside the United States and up to 2 new distribution centers. They said that both of these areas of growth were going to contribute to around 10,000 jobs. It is unclear if these 323 Dollar Express stores that are to be closed on in the month of June are going to add to that expansion count. Again, you're talking about a job creation of about 10,000 jobs. You would wonder if it's going to be a little bit less because of some of those existing stores. But then also, Trent, you have to think about, is that 323 Dollar Express store count going to end up being included in those 1,000 stores? And if so, their capital expenditures overall could be a little less because, as many of our listeners know, Dollar General tends to build from the ground up with their new locations in their smaller markets. But overall, the larger ramifications inside the industry, and this is something that an analyst pointed out in one of the articles I was reading actually just before the podcast, we're seeing that the FTC may be a little bit more hesitant going forward with that Walgreens Rite Aid deal. Of course, they don't have much more time, only about a couple more weeks to decide on that deal, but they could be more hesitant in accepting the divestment from Rite Aid. You're saying that those up to 900 locations from Rite Aid are going to be divested to make this deal go through. And this is something that Walgreens has been eyeing for some time. We had talked on previous episodes about them tinkering with that count. As low as maybe 400 locations, up to 1,300 locations had all been proposed to be divested from the company. But you see here, with all of the problems from this Dollar Express story, you have to wonder if the FTC is not monitoring that situation very closely. As it relates to the shares of the companies involved in the story, Dollar General spiked early on Thursday, nearly 5% to a 6-month high, currently around $79 a share. Dollar Tree also spiked on Thursday, in large part, Trent, like you said, to the overall stock market doing very well, treating retailers in a very positive way on Thursday. So Dollar Tree was up 5% as well. While shares have been mostly flat for the past 10 months for the Dollar Tree banner, they are down overall over the past 52 weeks.
We move on to the final story for the first segment of the Retail Focus podcast, and this entails Walmart. One of the things we touched on in our Looking Ahead segment last week, Walmart had their annual meeting during the course of this last week. And again, it's not so much a shareholders day as it is a shareholders week. It took place over the course of several days. A lot touched on here, but we had mentioned before the shareholders meeting that we were curious to see what the balance was between brick and mortar and e-commerce, as far as what Doug McMillon's message was going to be, as far as how much FaceTime that Mark Lohr was going to get their new e-commerce CEO. And as it turns out, the amount of information was heavily tilted towards e-commerce, as we expected, although I was kind of caught off guard the fact that brick and mortar was almost completely left out of the equation, other than to say the brick and mortar roots of Walmart gives it an overall competitive advantage when competing in the new e-commerce marketplace. But Leighton, a number of different ideas unveiled here, and we're more focused on the ideas than the event itself. What were some of the things that Walmart had mentioned at the shareholders meeting in Northwest Arkansas?
Looking over the notes, it was somewhat surprising, however, not overall too exciting. As I had asked you before recording this podcast about the dynamic and what we expected going in as far as the split between how much they talked about brick and mortar and how much they talked about boosting their e-commerce sales. Well, it certainly has shown through this investor day or investor week that they have been focused more on e-commerce and applying more capital. And you see their CEO, Mark Lohr, their CEO of e-commerce, I should say, said that the focus is going to be obviously e-commerce, but really trying to give customers extra value. And by that, he means trying to equate a value proposition for the customers where they won't have as much shipping costs and delivery won't take as long to get to the customers. In fact, if you look through some of the numbers, they said 70 to 80% of their shipping costs actually come in the last mile. And so Walmart, with as much cash and operating capital as they have, they really do offer an interesting proposition, because if they want to spend more money to try to boost e-commerce and compete with the giant that is Amazon, they can do so. And like Amazon, they can take a hit in the short to mid-term in terms of profitability and their gross margins in order to try to gain their customer base on the e-commerce side of the business. And you see, Mark Lohr really is transitioning a business to one that is a little bit more agile. Doug McMillon, their CEO and former CEO of the Sam's Club division, they are all on board, and they say that this really is the future of retail, being able to slow down and be a bit more agile. And they said they really don't have any more time to celebrate their previous success. You see, in the last quarter, which we talked about on this very podcast, was a very positive one. You saw same store sales increasing beyond analyst expectations, and you saw their overall bottom line increasing as well. A lot of positive news that caused the share price to go to a one-year high, but they said that they can't really enjoy that right now because they have the future of retail to attend to. And I think that this is really what the investor week was about here. As you saw, the first quarter income of $3.04 billion is really just a piece of the company that's going to be transitioned into this larger e-commerce space. Overall, Trent, a lot to be talking about here, and a very interesting shipping program they are considering piloting in the future.
Yes, and we should keep in mind as we talk about this new potential, as Leighton called it, a shipping or delivery program, that this shareholders meeting is more for the shareholders than to disclose a lot of meaningful information. So there's a lot of statements that are certainly forward-looking, but it's meant to impress the shareholders, which is why we don't see a whole lot about brick and mortar in this case, because I would guess that a lot of investors, Wall Street, and a lot of media outlets don't want to hear a whole lot about brick and mortar, given the considerable negativity in the media surrounding brick and mortar, even though I think we would both agree that not all is doom and gloom when it comes to the physical stores. But what they are calling this is an associate delivery program. They unveiled this on Thursday, and the idea was hatched by Mark Lohr, or at least a member of Lohr's team in the online operations division of Walmart. The idea is that Walmart has stores within 10 miles of 90% of the U.S. population, and they have all these associates driving into these Walmart stores to work. So the idea came about, why not have the associates deliver packages, deliver merchandise from the Walmart to these stores on their way home from work? And on its surface, this looks like a fantastic program. It's a good idea, right? You have hundreds of associates at each Walmart store on average, depending on certainly the size of the Walmart store. You may have more or less than that. Why not tap into some of that human capital you already have on staff and maybe create last mile services that are less of a cost to the company? This service will be tested soon, beginning soon at least, at two stores in New Jersey and one in Arkansas. To this point, the stores have not been revealed by Walmart. Walmart has 1.2 million employees, 4,700 U.S. stores, and it remains to be seen exactly when they plan or if they plan on expanding this program to all of their stores. And again, surface-wise, this looks like a great program, and you can understand why shareholders would be maybe jumping onto this program, which is, again, an opt-in program for associates. So if you work at a Walmart, you're not obligated to take part in the program. And obviously, if you take public transit or walk or ride a bike or whatever to your shift at Walmart, as many in certainly the more urban locations with robust transit systems may opt to do, you don't have to opt into the program as well. But as their Walmart spokesman, Ravi Jariwala, said, these employees driving home represent what he calls a very dense web of potential delivery locations for the company. There will be certainly weight and size limits on packages for certain employees. Employees will be able to use a developed app, in theory, to specify how many packages they're willing to deliver and what they would be willing to deliver. But of course, like with that program, there comes a score of worries for Walmart as well.
Yeah, this was our main concern when this story popped up, because you're talking about a company right now that has trials in both Arizona and Colorado, sort of outsourcing a home delivery program, trying to take care of that last mile delivery. And you see that by doing this, they're offshoring all of that potential litigation. If something were to happen negatively during the transaction, they are not going to be liable, and therefore it's less of a financial burden. But anytime you have the associates that you're paying on an hourly basis trying to drop off packages from nearby stores, it could be a potential problem. So it's not only going to be a complex problem from the logistics standpoint, but it could also be one that ends up in a slew of lawsuits down the line. Obviously, Walmart, a multi-billion dollar company, has thought about this, but at the end of the day, it's all about the cost-benefit analysis. So I feel if they look at this program or potential program and see that the costs really are outweighed by the benefits, then I think this is something that will be successful for them. This really isn't for lack of trying either. They are thinking outside the box, as you had mentioned. Their team really has been trying to innovate, and they're saying that they are in the business of inventing. And I think this is really speaking to that, about thinking outside the box. You see companies like Amazon doing things like this all the time, and I feel like it would be questioned a little bit less, in fact, if a company like Amazon were to come out with something similar. But as for Walmart, again, they do have the cash and they do have the ability, and we really do have to applaud their efforts into try to boosting their omni-channel network, because they have the cash and for years they've been ignoring it. And then also, if you trace back the current CEO, Doug McMillon's roots, like I said, to Sam's Club, which was for decades predominantly just a brick and mortar retailer that has now just been boosting both their omni-channel and e-commerce efforts, you see that the company is not stagnant. He's okay with opening up to the idea of these programs, these delivery programs, and boosting the capital that is going to be sourced into their e-commerce programs.
I think my main concern, you mentioned lawsuits and litigation. I think from the employee's perspective, again, it is an opt-in program, so there's no obligation there to perform as part of this program. But how do you approach it from Walmart's perspective? What do you do with insurance purposes if the employee gets in a wreck on the way there? A lot of last mile services, a lot of these delivery services employ drivers as independent contractors. So they assume basically all the blame because, again, they're doing independent contract work. However, Walmart said in the release surrounding this concept that they would comply with all minimum wage laws and all federal overtime laws, which would indicate that they're looking at having these employees, rather than being independent contractors as they're driving the packages home, full Walmart employees. So that creates issues with transportation, but it also unlocks the ability for the employee to write off certain expenses related to their car if they are opting into this program on their taxes. So there's a lot of give and take. They said overall, the response from Walmart team members has been positive, as they have a chance to make potentially extra income in delivering these packages on the way home. And again, you have to applaud the fact, as Leighton mentioned, that they are thinking outside the box. There are a few other aspects of the business that Walmart mentioned. They mentioned the idea behind potentially boosting wages and wage inflation. Again, a lot of protesters at this annual meeting, as there were last year, regarding the pay at Walmart. And this is something that Walmart has invested a lot of that cash into, making sure their employees are valued within the stores. But also, Walmart said they're going to continue to promote these academies that we last talked about last year, that allow store employees to kind of train and advance through the Walmart system rather than staying stagnant in the same position for several years. Walmart says it has about 160 academies already existing within their 4,700 stores, with a goal of reaching 200 stores with these academies in it by the end of the year. And Doug McMillon, again, said that the key to their success going forward is the human capital that they have, is making sure that everyone is trained. And even if you're not trained necessarily to be a manager, you can at least be trained to think like a manager, figure out ways to make the store more efficient on the ground level. And I do applaud what Walmart is doing also with this circumstance. I think for so many years, Walmart or working at a Walmart was correlated with maybe an entry-level job. And Walmart's trying to shake that stigma, very similar to what Costco has been able to do in the past with boosting employee pay, boosting employee training, and boosting employee morale. You can see that Walmart, although they are a little bit late to hop on that bandwagon, they are at least making an effort and trying to increase retention, which, again, in a climate of wage inflation and in our current jobs climate, is going to be crucial if they don't want to go through constant hiring expenses because of high turnover. The Retail Focus is brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. Do you ever wonder why the coffee you make at home never tastes quite as good as the coffee you buy at a coffee shop? Let me let you in on a secret. Coffee shops spend thousands of dollars to make the perfect water for making coffee, and now for as little as 10 cents per cup, you can duplicate that magic at home.
Third Wave Water has a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes for coffee brewing magic. Recently at the U.S. Brewers Cup Championship, both the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water.
Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com and use the promo code FOCUS, that's F-O-C-U-S, for 10% off your first order at Third Wave Water and thirdwavewater.com.
Well, the FTC is in our rundown again as they announced this week that Amazon will have to pay back potentially more than $70 million to parents for mobile app purchases made without their permission by their children. So an interesting story here. It's going to be a short one. However, the apps in question will have to have been purchased between November 2001 and May 2016. A long-standing battle surrounded Amazon as those that brought the suit argued that the e-commerce giant did not have enough child-proofing mechanisms in place to prevent unwanted buys. So basically, the child was able to grab the smartphone or tablet or web page via the desktop and then easily make purchases that were not wanted by the parents. And this caused a lot of problems, both from the PR perspective and for parents trying to get their money back. But according to the FTC's website, anyone affected should have already been sent an email by Amazon. However, with that, they included a link for those that may have not received an email so they can go and click that Amazon link. And then also, requests can be completed either online or members can additionally call the company's 1-800 number that is related to this case. You can Google that. And then you see the actual case between the FTC and Amazon was actually settled last month, but this is just now making the headlines because the payouts are just now starting to happen. And we say that the case was settled, but really at the end of the day, Amazon ended up admitting fault and so they lost. But if you look back to the brief history, Trent, you see that in July 2014, federal officials said that it was too easy overall for kids to make what they called in-app purchases. Games like Candy Crush, etc., were being purchased without the parents' permission. And a judge in April of 2016 agreed with the notion that an Amazon member signing into a device and then leaving it out should not be under the impression they are responsible for anything that happens thereafter. So if someone then purchases over $5,000 worth of merchandise or in-app purchases, they are not going to be held accountable for those. And this honestly is, in my opinion, a logical stance. As you can see with the idea that if you were to leave a phone out on the street and it gets stolen, but it has a digital wallet in it, the phone's original user should not be held accountable for the purchases made with either the Android Pay, Samsung Pay, or Apple Pay applications that are with that device and tied to the consumer's credit card. So very interesting cases, Trent. And I think the main thing here for this story is that this was not the first time a similar case has appeared in front of the court.
Now, a precedent was set for this back in 2014 that involved Apple having to repay parents for app purchases that didn't have adequate parental controls. Apple has tightened up the App Store since then after having to pay out around $32.5 million in refunds, which is, of course, a drop in the bucket compared to the over $10 billion people spend annually in the App Store. And likewise, Amazon can handle this financially as well. Their first quarter results that were released on April 28th showed operating cash flow increasing 53% to $17.6 billion. Free cash flow increased to $10.2 billion. In a closing blanket statement related to the matter, the FTC said they exist to promote a competitive environment that protects and educates consumers, and they believe that they were doing so with this particular ruling. Moving on to our final story, Restoration Hardware in the news again this last week as their shares took a beating on Wall Street Friday after missing expectations to an extent. Shares fell over 25% after the release. Shares for Restoration Hardware have been extremely volatile, up and down both over the last 2 years. Meeting expectations was apparently not enough to uphold their massive price-to-earnings ratio, which went into the earnings call at over 380. In short, there were a lot of Wall Street expectations for a beat here, and their price-to-earnings ratio kind of showed that off. And we were kind of stunned that the stock had made it over $50 after bottoming out in the $20 to $30 range following all of their supply chain issues that took place last year. But I think perhaps more of the Wall Street reaction centered around the company lowering their second quarter earnings guidance, which was seen as a negative overall sign for the retailer. Leighton, what about these first quarter numbers here?
First, you hit it dead on. The expectations were missed if you're looking towards the forward guidance for the company. The second quarter is going to be a tricky one as the company is still in what they call a transformation phase. And I think a lot of analysts would agree after this earnings call. For the period ending April 29th, the upscale furniture retailer reported a narrower-than-expected net loss of $3.4 million, or about 9 cents per share. And this sounds bad, but last year they reported a loss of around $13.5 million, so it was indeed narrower year over year, and then on an analyst expectations basis, narrower there as well. On an adjusted basis, however, a non-GAAP basis, they did report profitability coming in with $1.8 million in net income, which equates to about 5 cents per share for those shareholders. Top line revenues were up to $562.1 million. And I thought this was a bright spot for the company because I thought, honestly, they would miss in this metric. They actually beat by about $2.1 million versus Thomson Reuters consensus estimates. This was up nearly 10% year over year from around $455.5 million in the first quarter of 2016. It should be noted, because it's important to put all of this in perspective, the first quarter of 2016 is when they started to have issues and started to make some strategic changes from within the company. So you see the numbers are a little bit inconsistent looking back over the past 5 to 6 quarters. Operating income was also positive, however, for the company. This quarter was coming in at around $6.9 million versus negative $11.5 for the same period last year. So you have to ask yourself, why are the shares down if they fairly met expectations this last quarter? Company management said they are taking a cautiously optimistic approach despite being in the midst of what they called, again, a transformational period. And the membership program and hands-on design approach with their customers is helping to strengthen their sales opportunity. But the question mark here, Trent, is that when questioned about these numbers, the growth rate within the memberships, they were not able to cite specific growth rates. And this is somewhat alarming because the membership program is something they've been bullish on over the past few quarters. They just had a blanket statement basically saying that the program is strong. And then when analysts questioned, well, how strong exactly is the program? They said, well, we can't release those numbers. So I think the answers they were giving were actually creating a little bit more pessimism than what they intended to. As for that conference call, it was a little bit odd because they only did the question and answer session. They didn't speak extensively about their business. And because of that, there were a lot more questions being asked than you would normally see during a conference call on an earnings report. For that second quarter, as you mentioned, Trent, they're going to be seeing less gross margins as a result of stagnant inventory. And before I hand this over to you, Trent, this is something I want to touch on briefly, in that With a business that is upscale, you have a lot of inventory that costs a lot of money. So if something's sitting around, if something's not moving, that is going to be expensive for your company, not only in the short term, but in the long term. You're going to have to take those markdowns eventually. And because of that, you're going to be seeing less gross margins and more operational problems because you can't use that capital to then reinvest into your business. So overall, it becomes a ballooning of the problem. And I think this is something that analysts were hanging on to, and that this is a company that any upscale company really prides themselves on seeing very healthy margins, and they use that extra margin in order to create their brand, to build into their brand. And for them, they create a lot of interesting showrooms that cost a lot of money. And when you're not able to do that, you're not going to be able to grow. And this is a problem. And I think that is one of the reasons why shares were down that 25% figure.
One of the other aspects of their margins is the fact that they have been eroded somewhat by this membership program. And I don't know about you, but I was pretty irked at the fact that they couldn't give specific membership renewal rate information during the analyst Q&A, especially since they didn't address any information about their company to begin the earnings call with. So I found this odd as well. But remember that the membership program gives you a blanket discount on everything you buy from Restoration Hardware if you pay that one-time fee. And what we're seeing, or at least what we've seen from last year's membership program results, is the fact that membership program members do spend more overall at Restoration Hardware, but that erodes the margins as much as 20 to 25% at Restoration Hardware. So that's also cutting into their margins. On the positive side of things, Restoration Hardware, RH Hospitality, is seeing investment, but mostly in their program leaders, little mention of any marketing campaigns or program enhancements. And as Leighton mentioned, their brick and mortar stores are really galleries more than actual brick and mortar retail stores. No specific insights as far as any openings in that category, other than that they have identified several target markets, which is not necessarily new news. They've said the same thing on previous quarterly results. Their CEO, Gary Friedman, did note that their real estate deals are not cookie cutter. Certainly, Restoration Hardware stores are in unique locations, and they all take on unique textures architecturally. They're not taking a one-size-fits-all approach with the building sizes or lease conditions, and this is probably for the best going forward for them, to hedge demand risk in each new market. But they do want their galleries, they say, to upend the retail experience. They cited tourists taking pictures in their Chicago gallery, said that that type of experience is going to be hard to replicate if you're the competition. Don't tell IKEA that, because they get the same type of feedback from their galleries and their stores in the United States. This is a way that Restoration Hardware feels like they can differentiate themselves. Again, IKEA kind of does the same thing, but styles do change. And long term, they've got to keep ahead of the curve rather than behind it, which is where they've been over the last couple of years. They need to have a 5 or 10 year plan. And I think, honestly, they need to be communicating this to shareholders. By not answering or not fully answering all of the analyst questions during the earnings call, I think that tanked their earnings perhaps more than their soft outlook. But they mentioned they don't see Amazon or Wayfair as credible threats to the business. We've heard that before. And they think they have a strong brand. That's what their focus is on, in brand building. But their earnings outlook did get cut down from their previous guidance of about $100 million or so. And earnings per share are now projected down to $1.67 to $1.94 per share, from a previous forecast of $1.78 per share to $2.19 per share. And again, these are non-GAAP measures, because on a GAAP basis, they did show a loss for the last quarter. Shares stayed down through trading Friday after taking that hit Thursday when all other retail stores were seeing a surge. Restoration Hardware saw a downturn at the end of the week. It was trading at $57 per share before the earnings release, now around $42 per share. Still up about $7 per share from a year ago. Remember, we mentioned that it was even in the $20 range. Price to earnings ratio now adjusted to 115 times, so down significantly from where it had been. And that price to earnings is, again, on non-GAAP earnings. They still have a $1.44 billion market cap, so still an enormous business, but I don't think either Leighton or I am in complete agreement with their outlook and with their ability to completely turn around Restoration Hardware to what it was even 3 or 4 years ago.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus, and to wrap it up as we do every week, we'll tell you about a story we're looking ahead towards for the next week or month, and we begin with Leighton.
So mine has something to do with e-commerce and omnichannel, something that we've talked about a little bit here with Walmart's Investor Week. But athletic apparel maker Lululemon had actually come into some issues here recently with their website. The website was down for about 20 hours. This happened midday on May 22nd. And this is a story of mine because this has larger implications for all of retail, because a lot of retailers don't house their e-commerce data in-house. They use clouds that are sourced from other companies. And in this case, they use IBM for their service cloud. And this is something that is going to be coming up and is very interesting. We talk about online safety a lot. A lot of hackers out there trying to access customers' data. And then a lot of outages too. We talk about a lot of airlines here recently having issues with their IT systems. Well, this obviously affects the bottom line because you're not getting those sales for the 20 hours that you're down. And the response from the company is what was notable here, Trent, and that Lululemon CEO Laurent Potdevin actually outwardly blamed IBM not long after this happened and was recently quoted by CNBC into saying their team was talking to IBM for upwards of 36 hours to try to find the root cause of this. And I quote, "We're not satisfied with what happened. We're looking at our options," end quote. And so you see a response like this and you really have to wonder if this is going to be an issue going forward. Obviously, Amazon has a very large cloud service. They have AWS, and a lot of retailers actually use that because they see it as a safe, comfortable, consistent platform. So I'm curious to see if Lululemon actually utilizes the Amazon platform going forward, because this is something that a lot of other retailers have been doing, is trying to look for the most safe and secure option for their customers. Consistency is the key. Obviously, a lot of their sales are derived from their e-commerce space. Lululemon has a lot of brick and mortar stores, but they pride themselves on merchandising their apparel on their website as well. So a very interesting dynamic and a story I wanted to cover for my looking ahead.
My looking ahead story actually has a little bit of a sports bent to it, as this last week, Martin Truex Jr. actually took the points lead for the NASCAR Monster Energy Series, which is the premier NASCAR series. Now, the reason that's important is this is the first time a car fielded by Furniture Row Racing has led the NASCAR points. And granted, there are other sponsors on Martin Truex's car besides Furniture Row, but the fact that Furniture Row, a retailer, more or less owns a race team is pretty impressive. They invested in this team a little over 10 years ago to kind of start up their own marketing. And the reason I'm looking ahead at this story, I'm anxious to see how much more crossover marketing they're going to get now that their team is fully marquee in this sport. And I'm wondering how much crossover there may be between NASCAR fans or Martin Truex Jr. fans and Furniture Row. Now, Furniture Row has been known in the sport for some time, but now they're actually making national news for the success of their two-car team. And I'm anxious to see if this parlays into improved sales going forward for Furniture Row. That'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. A quick reminder that you can check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast for all the day-to-day retail news that we're not able to catch up on during the podcast. Also, make sure you follow us on Twitter, because we'll be posting links to our new YouTube series as businesses release earnings on, say, a Monday or Tuesday, and we can't get it until a later week's podcast. We'll actually be uploading videos with some instant analysis on earnings, calls, and developing retail news stories of the week. So make sure you keep an eye out for that. We're going to try and do one a week here for the next few weeks. and see how it goes. Big thanks again to Third Wave Water and thirdwavewater.com. Visit them, use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order and start making better coffee today. For Leighton, I'm Trent. So long until next week in Food Focus.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.